It's good to be with you again. It was at this seminar, this conference last year, that I took a look at some of the research that had been done and noted some big ranges in recruiting and retention of African Americans in research. And I walked out thinking, I have a fairly good idea of what some of the reasons are for why some research studies do better in recruiting and others don't, but I don't know that I have all the reasons. And I thought it was perhaps time to look at just what the research suggests as to what are the factors that facilitate participation of African Americans in research. Again, we're in a climate of really working towards improving health disparities, and we can't get there unless we have research that addresses the needs of broader populations. I think we all know that it was, 20, 30 years ago when most of the research was done purely on the Caucasian race and mostly on men. And that research doesn't always translate well, especially in terms of health services. So with that said, I took a look at, using the MeSH terms, African-American, minority, and research. I used CINAHL, I used PubMed, and I used ScienceDirect, and I initially started off the search 1995 through 2011 at the time, and then I added 2012 as we went along. It was interesting to include health conditions in the search terms, and I tried including neck pain, I tried including back pain, and there was nothing. And so most of these are studies. Now, the studies were still, there's still plenty of information from cancer studies and even from some dietary studies and preventive care studies, but non-specific to some of the conditions that we cover. So I narrowed it down for this presentation to 11 papers that I thought encompassed the general themes of most of the studies, and they're actually pretty consistent with what is shown to help and what is shown to be problematic. And my overview is then going to cover what works, what doesn't work, the barriers, the facilitators, and then just close with one or two recommendations. So what works, bar none, pretty consistently, is participant recruiter-like ancestry. When somebody who seems to represent the community goes back into the community to recruit, both for recruiting and retention, the data is very helpful. Now, I should just say that even though it works and works quite well, there are still a few hindrances to that. And those hindrances center around things like age and education. What else works? High-yield venues. So cancer studies going to a cancer treatment research center. Prenatal care studies, maternal and infant health environment. So going into the high-yield venues tends to yield, again, for recruitment and retention, good participation. Particularly for those of us who work in colleges, I would strongly encourage this sustained presence in the community. And it builds around the historical distrust. There is just something about being there and staying there that says you're here to give to the community, not just here to take and then disappear again. And so for those of us who have colleges that maybe have community clinics, they are good sources for research data, because we're already established in the community. And for providers who are not yet established in the community, I'd encourage a sustained presence in the community because it does help to build trust. Seeking advice from community leaders. And you're going to hear me say a little bit more about this down the line, but seeking advice from community leaders who can help with things like, take a look at our questionnaires. Will this work with the community that we're planning to work in? Who can we contact in the community? Where can we get the most bang for our buck? What can we learn from you as we come in to do some research in your communities? And then less invasive methods. So giving the choice, say, between a chiropractic adjustment where there's a popping sound and a chiropractic adjustment where there's maybe an activator adjustment. Again, less is best. You know, when you looked at the studies where they did blood as opposed to saliva or bracing as opposed to distraction, pretty much less invasive resulted in greater retention in the studies. This one surprised me, the monetary incentives, because I had always been led to believe the monetary incentives were a good motivator. And it turns out that the results are mixed, that monetary incentives outside of an additional benefit to the participant, to the community, or to future generations just doesn't work as well. So if we're offering money and the participant feels that this is a disease that maybe is prevalent in the family, this is a disease that can be used to help their children, or the results can be used to build up the community, then monetary incentives become valuable. Otherwise, they're almost a deterrent in some ways, because they're almost considered to be, I don't want to use the word offensive, it's a strong choice of words, but there's some pushback with just money in and of itself. I should also say that, especially when you think of the chiropractic environment, that where we can offer a service that we maybe don't need for the study, is not confounded to the study, but is of a benefit to the patient, that in itself is also a plus. And what do I mean by that? Repeatedly, where you saw things like blood pressure added to a study, people coming back for their blood pressure checks ended up increasing retention, and then the researchers could use the time to collect the data that they needed for the topic in question. So I said earlier that community leader support was a big plus. Community leader support, absence like ancestry, and in the absence of like ancestry, absent relationship building was not a plus. And it comes back again to the issue of trust, is that if the community leaders feel as if they are conduits to gain, generally speaking, it didn't help things very much. If there was relationship developed between the researchers and the community leaders, so there's a trust factor already built in, then that was beneficial. And then media, very mixed results with the media. What I will say is that the research that showed good evidence with media was where a specific zip code had been targeted, and that was then followed up with a phone call. Otherwise, it seemed that it was just all over the place. At a cost of about $250 per research participant, phone calls and a targeted zip code seemed to be a good ROI. So I'm going to spend a few minutes on the issue of distrust, and because the big umbrella overarching all of this is just that the distrust of the system that came from poor research practices that have gone back decades. We're all familiar with the Tuskegee study, but it's just one of different types of studies where minority populations have been used for the purpose of research, and that stays. And that's the real tragedy of it, that it's hard to rebuild trust once it's been broken. But having said that, some of the other reasons given is that researchers don't do research until participants want to know how the research information is going to be used. Research participants are deceived by researchers. Researchers do harmful experiments without the patient's knowledge. They want to know more than they need to know. They use minorities as guinea pigs. And then the one that perhaps surprised me the most was this misinformation about the possibility of losing insurance if you take part in a research study. So what that again speaks to is the need for a fair amount of education up front, and then B, really working to build relationship. The research is compounded by sort of the research framework, which involves written consent. And you're looking at cultures where oftentimes the oral tradition is much more valued than things in writing. And so written consent proved to be a barrier. And just the vast amount of documentation that's needed for consent. And then researchers need to look at themselves as well, because you have situations where researchers were ascribing stereotypical behaviors to their participants. And that, again, created some challenges. other barriers, less education. Less education worked two ways. Less education required a lot of extra information up front because there was so much misinformation. But when you looked at participants with less education and you looked at pediatric research, oftentimes they were more willing to have their kids involved in research if they thought that the outcomes could benefit their kids and give their kids a better health outcomes. Family pressures, feeling overwhelmed, feeling a little bit strained, and just not having the time to participate in the study resulted in investigators and sometimes perceiving noncompliance. And the issue was not noncompliance. The issue was participants feeling overly burdened prior to coming into research. What are motivators? Civic duty, monetary compensation, when weighed in with some of the other things that I mentioned earlier, the benefit to future generations, and the potential promise of research improving the health of the community. What are facilitators? We heard some cultural competence factors mentioned earlier. Knowing how to address elders in the community, recognizing that elders want to be addressed with Mr. or Mrs., not necessarily with first names. Formal attire. Informal attire was oftentimes equated with poor work. And so coming in dressed appropriately was another factor. When the request to participate came from somebody in authority, either the patient's physician or a senior researcher on the study, and when provider support was gained. So provider support, with providers providing health care in the community, I would suggest is very important, and being aware of some of the things that keep providers from wanting to refer the patient, not the least of which is feeling they might lose the patient and or they're not getting feedback from the researchers. So, final recommendations are to develop relationships with the target community before the research study is to begin. Get into the community, meet the community elders, stop in the barbershop, visit civic groups, and so on and so forth. Have the conversations about what one can learn from each other. So it's not just what researchers call the helicopter approach, where you land, take your results, and leave. And help to identify what ways the study can give back to the community. Recognizing the intra-group groups are not homogenous, and then self-reflection on one's own assumptions prior to going into the research study. Why was this group chosen? And is there intent to benefit the group? And last but not least, this I think is really important, is consider working as an integrated team. So rather than the research team going in separately, find other healthcare providers in the community, either it's community clinics, who one can then collaborate with to do the study, rather than trying to set things up separately. Enthusiastic, altruistic providers are a great benefit, and then, like I say, disseminating the results back to the community. We heard some comments made about eligibility criteria and the research design. To the extent that it doesn't compromise the research, be willing to alter the design a little bit based on feedback from community providers. Of course, that might require some legislative changes. If you're going to give an oral consent as opposed to a written consent, that requires some big changes in the way we do research right now. But that is something to think about. Thank you.